It's from the old classic Say Anything. You may not have recognized the movie simply because nobody knows those scenes. It's just sort of like it's a really side random character in the movie that almost has nothing to do with the plot or dialogue, but it's very relevant to what we'll be looking at this morning in our series on detox, and that is, you know, removing the toxic influences and sometimes people from your life. And I start off last week with some disclaimers. One of the disclaimers is I have a hard time just with simply, you know, anybody who's going to label somebody else, especially if you're thinking about labeling somebody as toxic. I see people quickly write somebody off. They label them as difficult or unteachable or as a loser or as toxic or beyond hope or evil or wicked. And oftentimes the reality is that maybe just you weren't doing a good job communicating or leading, or maybe they're in the wrong role, or maybe there's, you know, a change needs to happen, and maybe it's a corporation change or a external change. Maybe they're not really them. Sometimes, you know, they're the voice of truth, and sometimes maybe you're the fool and they're the voice of truth, and so you're labeling them as toxic because to you, truth is toxic. And so therefore, anybody who's bringing you a message of truth, you label them as toxic. So that's why we get to the second disclaimer I have to say, and that is, before you try to apply anything from this message, please talk to a Christian counselor or a pastor for direct application. Are we clear on that? Because it is very easy for you to feel like as if the voice of God is speaking to you right now for you to make a life change. Normally, I want you to make some life change as you move through time of a message together. However, this morning, I'm just going to simply say, talk to somebody before you go and apply this message to your personal life, because I don't want to get a message saying, I got a divorce because of your message. No, what I want to hear you say is, your message has spurred me to ask some questions. Are you available? Or is Pastor Chris available? Or I need to go talk to somebody about it. That's an okay email, okay? That's as far as we're going to go with it. So that's kind of my disclaimers where we're going to be at this morning. And then last thing I just kind of say as we kind of move into it, there are some things that we think are Christian that aren't. And there are some things that are Christian that we don't think are very Christian. And so just to keep in mind, there are some things that we think are Christian but aren't. There are some things that we think are Christian, but they're not Christian at all. And what I mean by that is there are some times where we allow toxic people to have an influence in our life because we think the Christian thing to do is to keep working on them and keep, you know, giving them another chance, another chance, another chance, and another chance, because that sounds very Christian-like to do. There are other times where God is clearly saying, walk away. You have nothing to do with this person anymore. And we're thinking, yeah, but that doesn't sound very Christian to do that. That I don't think I'd be very Christian to do that kind of thing. And God's like, why? I did it time and time again. Have you not seen my track record? I waited 40 years for them people to leave before we went to the promised land, right? They complained, they grumbled, they wanted to go back, they didn't believe we could go. So I said, okay, I am not doing this with you. I am not going that. As a matter of fact, there are people who God says, okay, you want nothing to do with me, eventually he grants them that ultimate separation, and for all of eternity, they end up being separated from him because it's what they want in the end. And he says, okay, I am not going to, you know, spend all eternity with somebody who doesn't want to be there and doesn't want to be with me at all. You can't do a toxic relationship forever. And so we kind of want to begin with sort of that understanding. Last week, we looked at how in the Old Testament, especially the book of Proverbs, we see there's three kinds of people they fall in three categories. There's the wise, the fool, and the wicked. The wise are somebody who hears truth, and they want to change their life to line up with reality. I want to tell me what it is that I'm not seeing that's really there. Tell me what is true, because I want to live in the truth, I want to live in the light, and I want to adjust my life such that I can live in reality the way that I need to. The fool, however, looks at it, and the fool doesn't like the truth. The fool expects the truth to somehow change to meet their reality. Like, in other words, I want to live in fantasy land, and I want to continue to believe the things I believe, and so I want you to just alter truth. I think the truth needs to be changed. I think we need to change the parameters. I think we need to change the perspective on this so I can continue doing foolish things and have everybody else accept it. So that's what the fool wants to do. The wicked person, I would dare even say, doesn't care what truth is. They say, I'm going to continue doing my own thing because I'm me, and that doesn't matter. I don't care what the truth is. I don't care what you say. I'm just going to keep on doing it. The Holloman Bible Dictionary describes truth simply as this: that which is opposed to God and his purposes. Very simple definition. Evil is that which, or a person who is opposed to God and his purposes. It goes on to talk about how evil is both a choice and an action. It's a choice and an action. This was probably the key part. That can take root in one's heart such that it defines their thoughts and actions. We're talking about the evil person. We're talking about somebody whose thoughts, their actions, are down an evil path such that it is, let me make sure I get that word right, that it has taken root in their heart such it is defining their thoughts and their actions. Where you just look at somebody and the words that are coming out of their mouth, the schemes that are coming out of their mind, where they're planning, what they're thinking, what they're saying, what they're doing, you look at all of it and you say, this is totally opposed to anything that God would want to see happen in our relationship. This is opposed to anything God would want to see happen where we work. This is opposed to anything God would want to see happen between any two people or any group of people. This is not at all God's purposes. This person is just so far down this path. I sort of think of, sorry for the Star Wars analogy, but you know, I mean, there's this question, is Anakin going to give in to the dark side? And it's this picture that it's mirroring reality where somebody's sitting there and everybody goes down wicked paths. You do, I do. Jeremiah points this out in Jeremiah 17:9. He says, the human heart is deceitful above all things. It is desperately wicked. Yes, your heart is desperately wicked. There's wickedness in every one of our hearts. It's part of our sinful nature. And he goes on to say, who could possibly understand just how bad it is? We always like to think everybody has a good heart, right? Well, they've got a good heart. I've got a good heart. You've got a good heart. And God's like, no, you're fooling yourself. There's wickedness in your heart, right? At the root of all, people always ask, you know, are we born sinful? Are we born basically guilty of sin or the propensity to sin? I say, well, let's clearly do this. Everybody's born selfish, right? Every baby is born selfish. All they care about is their own needs. Parenting is the process of trying to remove enough selfishness out of a child's life such that they are tolerable for the rest of society. Is that a fair, accurate assessment? And if you look over somebody who's been raised in a home with poor parenting, they're an extremely selfish person. Is that fair? And so the process of parenting, because you can't remove it completely. Every one of us is still selfish. Why? Because our hearts are wicked. The wicked part of our heart is a part that is still very selfish. And there's a difference. Let me also delineate. There's a difference between people who do evil things and somebody whose heart is just basically gone to the place of wickedness. For instance, Paul writes about his own life. This is a guy who's writing scripture. He says, I know the good. It doesn't dwell in me. It's my sinful nature that's dwelling in me. I have a desire to do what's good, but I can't carry it out. I want to do what's good. I want to do the right thing. I just can't seem to carry it out. He says, I don't do the good I want to do, but the what? What's he say? The evil I don't want to do, that's what I keep on doing. See, so it's possible for you, a good person, if you will, because we're all good people, right? We're talking about those people out there this morning. Even somebody who is good like Paul, who wants to do good and is not an evil person, still does evil. He's like, you know, I want to do good things, but I still do evil things. So it's all of us do evil things. But I'm trying to make a difference between that kind of person and the person that Paul describes over in Philippians chapter 3 when he says, mimic and follow after my way of life and the kind of life I'm trying to live. Don't follow after, he says, this kind of person. He says, for as I often told you before, and now tell you again in many tears, many people live as enemies of the cross of Christ. This is just how they live. This is their way of life. He says, their destiny is destruction. Their God is their stomach. In other words, whatever they desire, whatever they want, whatever they want to consume, they will consume everything in their path because it's all they care about. Selfishness is their God. It is their idol. It is all they worship. He says, their God is their stomach and their glory is in their shame. And their mind is just set on earthly things. They only think about the here and the now and themselves. Perfect picture of a toxic relationship is a book that I loved as a kid. I thought it was just one of the greatest books ever. My youth pastor used to read this book. My mom would read this book to me. And I loved the book. Remember the book by Shel Silverstein called The Giving Tree? Isn't that a good book? It's about a toxic relationship, though. Do you ever realize that? On the one hand, you've got this tree who so loves this young boy. This tree will do anything for this boy. And it just makes the tree happy that the boy will come and enjoy the shade and play in its branches and climb it up. But the boy then later on comes back and says, I need money. I want money. The tree says, well, I don't have any money, but I can give you my apples. You can take and sell my apples. And so sure enough, the boy takes all the apples from the tree and he goes off and he sells them so he can make money. Later on, the little boy wants to build a house. So the tree's like, well, I don't have a house, but you could take my branches if you really needed a house. So sure enough, the boy strips the tree clean and makes some branches and takes all the branches and makes a house out of it. And then later on, the boy comes back and says, well, I'm not satisfied with my house. I want more. I want to go travel. I want to see the world. And she says, well, you know, if you chop down my trunk and hollow it out, you can make yourself a canoe, a boat, whatever, and sail off wherever you want to go. Okay, I'll do that. And chops down the tree and takes off. And when you get to the end of the book, what do you have? You got this man who's lived his life doing nothing but consume, 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 take, 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 and you've got a tree that literally has nothing left. That is a picture of a relationship with a toxic person. They've taken everything from you, there is nothing left of you, and they're still not satisfied. That's pretty much what it looks like. And God says, I refuse to have an eternal relationship with somebody who's going to treat me like that. Because you can't. You cannot have an eternal relationship with somebody who is going to take, 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 take. God's desire is that you become more like Jesus Christ, who did what? Gave his life away. Because the only way you can have an eternal relationship with somebody is if they think about somebody beyond themselves. And for the evil person, they're just so consumed with themselves. That's all they do. They just take, 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 take. The evil person, what ends up happening is that their selfishness is so taken over their soul, they get to the point where all they can see is hurt, and all they can feel is pain, and all they can feel is anger. It's just hurt and pain and anger and hate. And when somebody is so consumed with their own hurt and pain and hate and anger, they just go down this path of just every action that comes out of their life is evil, and you have to be able to recognize it. And you'll hear them say things like, I will take this company down. You will rue the day you ever crossed me. They're bent on your destruction. They're basically aligning themselves right with Satan's purposes and saying, I want to kill, steal, and destroy everything that's good in this life or your life or this company. There are people who will say, I will make it so nobody will ever go to your church ever again. Spirit of Christ right there. That's great. That's what Jesus was hoping for. I'm glad you'll do that in his name too, by the way. You'll regret ever doing that to me. You'll regret this. They're just filled with hurt and anger and bitterness, and just consumes everything about them. There's several examples in the Old Testament of this. First, I want to look over to the relationship between Abraham and Lot. Abraham, if you know the story, you go through the book of Genesis, and you get to this point where the relationship that humanity has with God is slowly fading out, and so God is trying to sort of jumpstart and revive his relationship to redeem all of humanity after the garden and the fall, and everything just kind of continues to get worse and worse and worse, and God calls Abraham's dad to come and to come into the land that God's going to show him, but he doesn't go all the way. He stops halfway there, and so God then picks up with Abraham, and he says, okay, will you fulfill the calling that I placed on your father's life? Now I want you to leave. I want you to leave your family and go to the place I'm going to show you. And his nephew Lot wants to come along with him. Lot's father apparently has passed away, so this is Abraham's brother's son, and Abraham doesn't have any kids, so he allows Lot to come down there with him. And shortly into their time into that area, it says this in Genesis 13. Pick him to verse 5. Now Lot was moving out about with Abraham, and he also had flocks and herds and tents, but the land could not support both of them while they were there together. For their possessions were so great, they were not able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abraham's herders and Lot's. And by the way, there were also the Canaanites and the Perizzites who were living in the land at that time too. So in other words, there is limited resources for the number of people there. There's enemies all around them, and these two groups are not able to get along. So Abraham turns to Lot and he says, hey, let's not have any quarreling between you and me, between your herders and mine, for we're close relatives. Isn't the whole land here before us? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. So Lot looked around and he saw the whole plain of Jordan was well watered like the garden of the Lord, just like Egypt. So Lot chose that place for himself. And the two men parted company. Abraham lived in the land of Canaan. Lot lived amongst the cities in the plain. And he pitched his tents near Sodom. And now the people of Sodom, by the way, were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. There's a couple signs in here as to kind of some of the background and the root of what's going on. One of the hallmarks of a relationship with a evil person is your relationship never ever gets better. It just gets worse and worse and worse and worse, and at some point you get to the point where you realize there is no hope of this ever turning around. When you get to the place where there is no hope, you cannot see any possibility, any way through this, you have prayed through this, you have talked with this, you've tried counseling with this, and there is just no hope of this ever turning around. You get to the point where you say, okay, I think we need to separate ways. And you see a little bit of insight into Lot's disposition and the kind of person that he was and why this was a problem. Now, with Abraham being the elder and Lot being the younger, it should have been a situation where when Abraham said, we should part ways, Lot should have deferred to Abraham and said, well, you are the elder, you are my uncle, where do you want to go? I'll let you choose first. That's what he should have said. But what's he say? Okay, that sounds good to me. Hey, that place over there looks really good. This place over here looks like a desert. I'll take the good place. I'll take where all the good stuff is. I'll give you the leftovers. Once again, you see Lot's heart is all bent on selfishness. It's bent on himself, what's going to be in his best interest. And you could see maybe that's why there was some conflict between Lot and Abraham. And if you notice there, a little telltale sign at the end, it says, so he went out and he pitched his tent near Sodom. Now, if you've read anything out of the Bible, maybe many of you who don't know anything about the Bible, you probably have heard of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Two cities that became so evil and so wicked, God ultimately judged them severely, right? So it says he went to live near that area. Well, when you get down to chapter 19, he's not just living near Sodom anymore. You know where he's at in chapter 19? He's not just in Sodom. He's actually there at the, it says he was at the city gates, which to us is like, okay, he's right there on the edge? No. The city gates is where city council was. The rulers, the leaders of the city would be there at the gates. That's where people would go to have matters judged, disputed. That was basically like their open hearing court of the day. It's where all of the leaders of the city would be. In other words, when it says that he is sitting at the city gates, what it is saying is he's either the mayor or he's on the city council of the most wicked, evil city in the world. Right? Why? Because that's the kind of guy Lot was. Abraham could see it. That's why his herders, that's why his people and Lot's people were never going to get along. This was never going to work. I see that there's wickedness in your heart. You want to go off over there. You're going after selfish means. You're pursuing all of that. There's no respect for elders or for customs or anything else because all you care about is yourself. You're bent on your own thing to everybody else's destruction. And you go out to a place near the wickedness and you find yourself completely immersed in it. Now, the thing about this is just because they separate, it doesn't mean that Abraham doesn't still love his nephew. It doesn't mean that he's written him off and will never have anything to do with him ever again. What you see is in chapter 14, Lot gets in real bad trouble because the wicked kings he's hanging out with get into trouble with some other bad characters, and he ends up getting taken captive in the middle of a battle. And what does Abraham do? He goes help him out, and he rescues him. Do they live together after that? Nope. He helps him out and says, all right, you go back to your place, I'm going to go back to my place. I'm here if you need me, but we're not living together. He doesn't just cast him aside. He doesn't care. And then what you see over here, what this story whole thing that's going to play out in chapter 19, if you know anything about Sodom and Gomorrah, they ultimately get judged. And Abraham knows this is coming, and he prays and he pleads and he begs with God, and he says, God, will you please spare Lot's life? He doesn't want to see him come to destruction. He doesn't want to see him come to an end. Now, does he have reason to be bitter? Certainly he could have reason to be bitter. Does he have reason to despise him for the decisions that he's made and what he's done? He could. But he continues to love him, care for him from a distance, pray for him, and do what he can from a distance, from a safe distance. And it's a beautiful picture of maybe what needs to happen in a relationship that you might have where you say, you know, this togetherness thing is not working and there needs to be some separation. As we said last week, that phrase, I need to limit my exposure to this. Because your decisions, as destructive as they are, eventually are going to affect me or my children or my family in some way, and I can't continue to allow that to happen. So I need to limit my exposure here. I can help you, but I can't help you from this close. I can help you from afar. And so that's what he does. There are friends in your life that aren't friends. They're just people you've known for a long time. Does that make sense? They're not really a friend. They haven't really done anything friendly toward you. They're fools, and their heart has been on evil. And you call them a friend simply because you've known them for so long, and you need to get to the point where you realize, this person has not been a friend to me. They are not helping me at all in my life. They're just bringing me down into their dysfunction. There's people who you are in business with or in a partnership with or work with, and their greed has taken so deep a hold on their heart, you know they're cheating your customers. And it's only a matter of time before they cheat who? You. Because eventually they can't delineate between customers and friends. It's not there's no two categories between people I'm going to hurt and people I'm not going to hurt. Once your heart goes towards and gives itself over to greed and selfishness to that point, eventually you've seen it happen too many times, right? The person who cheats the customer will eventually cheat their business partners too. It happens every single time. There are family members who don't have your best interest in mind. It was always astounding to me two things. One, when I read the stat, and this was when I took one of the humanities electives I took in college was family developmental analysis. And one of the stats that showed in there was the number one cause of divorce in the first year of marriage is in-laws, family members. Isn't that hard to believe? And I remember reading that, and then years later, I'm in seminary, and I'm going back and restudying about the doctrine of marriage, and what's the first thing God says in marriage? Leave. Leave your family so you can cleave to your wife. And it becomes a real problem in relationships. And sometimes you need to leave. And leave doesn't mean you disown them. It doesn't mean you'll never talk to them again. But sometimes it means that you need to start a family for yourselves and realize, is there any kind of toxicity in my family of origin or your family of origin that is going to negatively impact our relationship? And you have to be able to analyze. You have to be able to look at that. And once again, before you decide on any of these things, talk to a Christian counselor or a pastor about the right application of what it is you're hearing here this morning. It's hard to let go of a toxic person, but in the end, it's worth it. How hard this is, we see in our next story we're going to look at this morning, and it's over in 1 Samuel chapter 16. 1 Samuel chapter 16, a little bit of the backstory here. Samuel's era, when Samuel becomes a prophet for the nation of Israel, prophet is simply somebody who is God's spokesperson to the people. When God wants to speak to the people, he would speak through Samuel to tell them what God has on his mind. The book of 1 Samuel is sort of the beginning of Samuel's ministry, and it comes right after the book of Judges. Judges would be the equivalent of the Dark Ages. I know the Dark Ages is technically, about 300 AD to 1500 AD, something like that. In the Bible, the Dark Ages is the era of the Judges. A lot of really bad Jerry Springer-type stuff happens in the book of Judges, okay? It's not a very good era. There's this phrase that keeps coming up over and over and over again, is everybody did what was right in their own eyes. In other words, everybody was a law to themselves, and a bunch of fools walking around deciding this is what I think is best, and so they would go do it. This is what's in my best interest, so I'm going to go do it. That was pretty much the era of the Judges. And coming out of that era, the people turned to God and they said, God, you're not enough for us. You're the problem here. Remember, what does the fool say? The fool sees reality and doesn't think that they need to change anything. They look at everybody else around that needs to change. And so they look to God and say, God, you need to change. You're really our problem here. The reason why we've had all these problems is because of you. And what you need to do is give us a king, God. Because that's what we want. That'll solve all of our problems. God says, You shouldn't have a king. I should be enough for you. Like, no, you're not enough. We want our own king. And so God gives them exactly what it is that they want. And he warns them every time. He says, listen, y'all go pick a king. Y'all go get a king in front of you, and he's going to be an absolute train wreck for you. And so sure enough, Saul becomes king, and he allows them to have a king that they want. And he is every bit the train wreck that God predicts it's going to be. He lets power go to his head, and he becomes egotistical with his power. He uses people. He's jealous of other people's successes. He deceives to satisfy his greed. He lies about his actions. And it's kind of like what you see happen sometimes is God will sometimes give you what you want, knowing full well that it's going to be a train wreck. Remember Jeff Foxworthy used to have this old thing. He talked about how childproofing wasn't a part of his era. He'd just say, you want to stick your finger in an electric socket? Give that a chance, you know? Try that out. See how that works out. And he had this phrase, hurts, don't it? Won't do that no more. There are some times where when you beg and cry out to God for something he's told you no repeatedly, at some point he'll just come back and go, all right, have at it. Give that a try. See how that works out. That's the kind of guy you want? Go ahead. See how that works out. That you want to chase after money? That's what you think is going to make you happy? Go ahead. Get some of that. Oh, you think that's going to solve your problems? You think that's going to work out for you? Okay, go for it. Just, how about this? I'll take a season off. I'll let you do you. That's exactly what God does over the nation of Israel. He says, hey, you want to do you? Do you. You want a king? Get a king. Here, this guy right here. He's perfect. He's everything you've been looking for. Everything you've said you need. And Saul is an absolute train wreck. And by the time you get to 1 Samuel 15, God finally says, all right, we're done with this. We're done with this. I'm moving on. I've had enough. Saul has lied one too many times. He then tries to justify his lying with a bunch of greed. He shows up and Samuel's like, God said, wait on me and you're not waiting. This is after God said, hey, take care of all this. He says, I did, but I just, took some of the stuff for myself. No big deal. I just, collected up a few of my own things. It's not a big deal, is it? Those are big deals to Saul. Those are big deals to God. It's just, a few $1,000s. What big deal? Why does the IRS care about that? They actually care about that, Saul. Actually, they care about that. They're going to come tell you how much they care about that stuff. And so when you get to end of chapter 15, God says, that's it. I'm out. and he's moved on. And so you open to chapter 16, and it says this. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul, since I have rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse, son of Bethlehem. I've chosen one of his sons to be king." But Samuel turns back to God and says, "Well, how can I go? If I go and Saul hears about it, he's going to kill me." Now, once again, you see a little bit about the disposition of the kind of guy Saul was, right? Samuel's like, "I can't do that. Saul finds out, he's going to try to kill me." He's like, so you look at this and you go, how is it? From the outside looking in, this is a dumb question, right? From the outside looking in, you're like, wait a minute. You're mourning and grieving over the fact that God has moved on and is asking you to move on. But in the same breath that you're mourning and grieving over this whole thing, you're looking at saying, well, I can't go do that. This guy that I'm all bent up about will kill me if I do something like that. I live under his threat. I live under his evil. I live under his terror. I live in fear of this person. But I just can't let him go. And now you know why I showed you the ballad of Corey and Joe at the beginning of this message. That's where she's at. Now, outside looking in, when you watch your daughter in this situation, when you watch your husband in this situation, when you watch your mother or father, when you watch a friend of yours in this situation, you look and you go, what are you doing? Seriously, how is this a hard decision? But come on, you've been there, right? You've been there in this situation where, that's why I began by saying, when we think about evil, we typically think of bin Laden and Hitler, something like that, and it's hard to look at somebody that you love or care about and recognize there's evil in their heart. Now, do you think Corey could ever look at Joe and say he's evil? She'll sing about it, right? She'll write 65 songs about his evil heart. But if you ask her, is he evil? No. I love you. You invade my soul, she says, right? It's so hard when you get to this situation where, because what happened, I know you, because you and I were the same. You have this sense where you want to believe the best in somebody, right? You want to see the best in somebody. You look at them and you see their potential, you see their talent, and you think to yourself, you know, they're just going through a rough time. You make excuses for them and the decisions that they've made. You just know that at some point they're going to kind of snap out of it. They're going to have that aha moment. You've heard them say these evil, destructive things, but you think to yourself, you know, they're just in a bad place. They just weren't thinking straight. You make excuses for them. You think to yourself, you know, at some point, you know, if I was in that situation, I know at some point the light bulb would come on. And I know at some point it's going to come on, and you just keep on thinking at some point they're going to have that aha moment, and they're going to change, and they're going to shift. You have these things where you remember the time where they were following after God, and they were making wise choices, and you could see that God was blessing you through them, he was blessing them through them, he was blessing other people through them. And you look back at the good times that you had, and you think to yourself, I know who they really are. I know this can't be who they truly are. I see the good in them, right? That's like Skywalker looking at his dad saying, I see the good in you. Oh, if it only ever happened like that, right? If it only ever, that's why it's a movie. That's why it's a movie, people. Darth Vader doesn't become the good guy in real life most of the time. You see all of that. You remember the good times, the faithful times. You know, the thing is, you know somewhere in your life, in your heart, that your future with them is over, but you got so attached to it and so tied to it and so caught up in it, and you were so certain this was the future that God had for you, you just can't let it go. And God's coming down and saying, Saul, how long are you going to mourn over this? How long are you going to stay stuck here? How long are you going to get to that point? And it's hard to accept that somebody can be that selfish. It's hard to believe that somebody can be so selfish that their heart becomes so hard that all they can see or feel is hurt and pain and anger and destruction. It's hard to get to that point, right? But the reality is everybody has wickedness in their heart. You do too. And if it's left unchecked, at some point, they can get to the point where their selfishness has hardened their heart so bad that God says, you know, I'm moving on. What I wanted for them, they're not following. They're not stepping into the future that I have. And God says, I have rejected him as king over Israel. I rejected him. Yes, I anointed him as king. Yes, I installed him as king. He's who you guys wanted, and it's who I gave you. I gave you exactly what you wanted. But I'm moving on now. And he says, I've moved on. I need you to join me in moving on. You see that in there? He says, I've rejected him as king over Israel. Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. What he's saying is, there's somebody else for you to anoint now as king. That same horn that you filled with oil and anointed Saul, I want you to anoint somebody else. You need to move on with me. Now, David, he says, I'm going to send you to the house of Jesse. One of his kids is going to be the next king. David, who he's talking about, goes on to become one of the greatest leaders in world history. Not just the nation of Israel, in world history. He's one of the greatest leaders in world history. He sets up a kingdom so large that his son becomes considered the wealthiest man to ever have lived. I don't know if that's still true or not, but of his day, it certainly was. That's the kind of power and influence that David wielded. He was, when you study world history, you study the great empires of Egypt and Persia, usually they don't put David in there. He's right up there with them, all right? He's right in that category. So much so that God ultimately would say, the kingdom that David sets up is the throne that Jesus will ultimately assume. That's pretty powerful stuff, isn't it? But here's a principle. Holding on to the grief over past blessings after that season has ended will keep you from enjoying the blessings God has for this season and the season to come. Holding on and grieving over and wanting to relive and wanting to go back to yesteryear, wanting to go back in time and want to do that all again and expect that God's going to continue to do the same thing he did before through the same person he did before and trying to relive past blessings is what's going to actually keep you from enjoying the blessings of this season or the season to come. You think for a moment, what if when God said, how long are you going to mourn over Saul? What if Samuel just looked back at God and says, God, I want to keep giving him another try. I just want to stick this one out. I don't care what you got coming next. I think we can make this work. What would God do? Eventually, he would look at Samuel and say, okay, Samuel, you can stay there, but I'm moving on. I'm not going to not anoint David as king to usher in everything I've got in store and everything I've got in plan, all the blessings that I want to bring to the people's way, and ultimately through all of humanity's way, through a descendant of the line of Jesse, of the line of David, everything I've got in store and all of my plans, I'm not going to hold them up for your mourning. So either you get with me and you fill your horn up and get on your way, or I'm going to move on without you. And if you look at the history of the church and you look at the history of God working with humanity, every single time it's always the same thing. I'll give you a season to mourn and to cry and to reminisce over what's been lost, but at some point you need to move on with me. Jesus dies in like AD 30. He gives that temple about another 40 years, and then he says, okay, no more temple anymore. If you're not with me, I'm leaving you. I gave you this season, you know, about 40 years for you to kind of work, kind of give up this temple worship, but I'm just going to let the Romans come in and destroy this thing. I'm moving on from that. Then you see in the book of Acts, you see God continually saying, I want you, hey, disciples, get out there. Get out of Jerusalem. Go out into all the world. Nah, we're going to stay right here. And persecution drives them out. The center of Christianity moves from Jerusalem to Antioch. Why does it move to Antioch? Because they're the only church who's willing to send anybody out. And eventually you see God trying desperately to get Paul to Rome. And Paul's like, I don't want to go to Rome. I want to go back to Jerusalem. You read the book of Acts. That's what he says. He's trying to get back to Jerusalem. And God says, don't go back to Jerusalem. They don't want you there. I don't want you there. I want you in Rome. Paul keeps on saying, you know, I really can't wait. I really want to come see you guys in Rome. I really feel like that's where God wants me to be. And God's like, yeah, because that's where I'm trying to get you to go. Paul says, no, I want to go back to Jerusalem. You know what happens when he gets to Jerusalem? He gets arrested, put on a prison ship destined for Rome. God, if he wants to continue to use you, he'll get you where you want to go. Sometimes it's in the belly of a dungeonous ship. Sometimes it's in the belly of a whale. If he hadn't given up on you, the journey is not going to be fun if you don't get with him. You with me on this? And sometimes, in some cases, he just says, okay, I'm moving on. Either you're moving with me or you're not. For some of you, the message you need to hear this morning is, I know this didn't turn out like you thought it would. I get that. I've been there. I know this isn't what you wanted. This isn't what you expected. It's not what, whom, or how you expected it to turn out. I know it's disappointing. But God's moving on. And it's sad sometimes when you look around and you see who can't move on there with you. And you've been through those times in life. You know, you've been in a company and you say, you know, the where our company's going next, these people can't go with us. They haven't been working out. They're not working with the team. They just can't go where I'm going to take you next. And Samuel, where I want to take you next, Saul's not going, and he's not going to go. Are you team Saul or are you team me? Doesn't mean you don't love him. Doesn't mean you can't pray for him. Doesn't mean that you give up on him for all eternity, that you condemn his soul to hell. You know, Abraham still cared for Lot. He still reached out for Lot. He still helped Lot. He still begged and pleaded God for Lot. But can you trust me? I know David's not much to look at. I know. I mean, he gets there, and what does Samuel do when he gets to David's or to Jesse's house? He picks out the next Saul. You notice that? Oh, look at this boy. He looks just like Saul. He's got to be the one. God says, no, I've rejected him. He says, I don't look at the things people look at. Y'all look at the outside. I'm looking at the heart. That scrawny kid out in the field, out with the sheep, tending the same sheep that would be out there one day, that would be like the shepherds who show up at my birth someday, that kind of shepherd who's out there writing poetry to me, that's a guy after my own heart. And he ain't much to look at right now. And I'm sure that Saul, while they walked into that room, anointed David, and walked out of there and said, God, I don't know what you're doing. But we got a strapping, powerful man in office right now named Saul. I don't know why we got to move on from him for this scrawny little kid that not even his dad believes in. But whatever, God, I guess you know what's best. Now, in hindsight, yeah. David is David. He's a man after God's own heart. Wrote 2/3 of the book of Psalms. Was the greatest king in Israel history. But you don't step into the blessings in the future that God has prepared for you unless you're willing to move on from the past. And sometimes that's people. And that's the hard reality. For what that looks like for you, remember, application, we're going to talk to somebody before we apply this. We all agree on that? Okay, let's pray. Father, I thank you for the fact that you haven't given up on me. And Father, just as your word says, and I've got to admit, there are some times where I'm the toxic person, where my heart has become so hard in a situation or towards a person that I truly do get bent on evil towards them. I want revenge. I want them to pay. I want them to feel the pain that I feel. So, Father, as we begin to examine our own life before we examine or apply this to anybody else, help us understand and see where it is that we've been the toxic and the evil and the wicked. And then, Father, the other thing we need to come to you before right now is just what are we mourning in our life and hanging on to that's keeping us from moving on with you? For some people, it's a person or a relationship. And it's keeping our marriage from thriving. It's keeping our business from growing. It's keeping me from excelling in school. Over the next couple of weeks, Lord, we're going to look at other influences in our life that have the same issue with us. Help us, Father, to choose you. Know, Lord, that you're not a one-trick pony. This isn't the only avenue of blessing that you can ever bring into our life, but you have more blessings in store. Help us to trust you for a David and to walk away from a Saul. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.